It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Donald Trump signed a Phase 1 trade deal with China yesterday, in which Chinese officials pledged to buy $200 billion in American goods. It's intended to ease trade tensions, but how will that affect manufacturers and farmers here in Pennsylvania? Post-Gazette reporter Daniel Moore was in the White House yesterday. He joins us now on the line from Washington. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Daniel, it seemed like a crowded signing ceremony. What was the atmosphere like?
Yeah, it was pretty festive. It was a packed east room of the White House. There was a lot of Chinese media there, as you can imagine, and a lot of Chinese would appear to be just visitors there, kind of soaking in the scene. And it was celebratory. I mean, the president was in great spirits. There were a lot of guests that he had invited that he introduced one by one. And it was a very festive atmosphere.
The president called it, quote, the biggest deal anyone has ever seen, end quote. You covered local business for years before going to the Capitol. What do you think? How big is it?
Yeah, the deal itself is pretty big, I would say. So there are a lot of numbers thrown out yesterday, but the heart of the deal is the fact that China is committing to buy $200 billion more in U.S. goods and services over a 2017 figure. So in 2017, as a baseline, the U.S. exported a little bit under $200 billion total. So this is more than doubling of that figure. And, you know, within that $200 billion, that's spread across the manufacturing sector, energy products like liquefied natural gas, coal and oil. The service sector got big commitments for China to buy a lot of their products. So it's a pretty astronomical figure, and this is all happening over the next 2 years. So that's driven some skepticism as well that, you know, how does China logistically meet these commitments?
Right. Trump said farmers are going to be so happy. Remind us, how has this trade war affected Pennsylvania, our agriculture community?
Sure. So President Trump kind of initiated this trade war way back in 2018. And in response, China imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. farming exports to China. So farmers have been shut out of the China market for the most part, especially soybean farmers, for the last year or two. And so they've been facing dropping commodity prices and lower demand for their products. So this trade deal definitely includes some wins for farmers in terms of opening back up access to the Chinese market, and hopefully prices will go up.
Mm-hmm. The $200 billion included, you mentioned, $75 billion on manufactured goods, $50 billion on energy products, $40 billion on services. Any sense yet whether that will help Pennsylvania industries, though?
Yeah, how this plays out for specific Pennsylvania industries kind of remains to be seen. And while there was a lot of cheering at the White House yesterday, the enforcement and oversight of making sure China actually follows through on the promise of buying all of these U.S. products remains the critical next step and will likely require a lot of work. Within those broad categories, it's kind of hard to know, you know, what will, for example, Pennsylvania hardwood was a last-minute addition as part of this deal, but it's hard to know whether hardwood will see as big of an increase as other commodities included under manufacturing. So it's kind of, wait and see how this is going to play out type of deal, but the enforcement is going to be key.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the hardwoods. China was a major purchaser of Pennsylvania hardwoods, correct?
They were, yeah. Pennsylvania was the number one exporter of hardwoods to China. So, this was a situation where China retaliated against the United States with tariffs. And so hardwood has been pretty much shut out of that market for the last few years. So opening back up that market is a pretty big deal. And having something in writing that says China must buy hardwood is a pretty big deal for those producers.
We're talking on the Confluence with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette Capital Bureau Chief Daniel Moore about the trade deal that the president signed yesterday with China and how it's impacting or could impact Pennsylvania. The president also talked about steel. In your reporting, he even referenced campaigning in Pennsylvania in 2016. So what did he say?
Yeah, this was a little bit of an aside, but he mentioned a campaign rally in June of 2016 in Pennsylvania, where he promised the steel industry, promised the coal industry that he was going to bring back their jobs. And a big part of that, of his agenda to do that, would be to tackle unfair trade practices. And, it's kind of notable in the deal. The deal is called a phase one deal, and that deal doesn't really touch steel overcapacity in China and steel dumping in the United States. And so that's something that, it includes all of these purchases for all these different industries, but we're kind of going to have to wait until a phase two deal comes along to address, these thornier questions about Chinese overcapacity and steel. So he has delivered in some ways, but, there's a lot that remains to be seen.
The steelmakers, American steelmakers, actually benefited from the tariffs, didn't they?
Yeah, the companies that melt and produce steel certainly benefited. Tariffs were 25% tariffs were put into place on imports of steel and aluminum into the United States, and so that helped demand for their product. There are a lot of companies that manufacture using steel products, and they import that steel from other countries. So there's a lot of U.S. manufacturing companies that oppose the tariffs because of that reason.
Mm-hmm. With just about a minute left, Daniel, China committed to $200 billion by 2021. What is the U.S. giving in exchange?
Yeah, sure. So the U.S. agreed essentially to lower some of the tariffs. So there were 15% tariffs on $160 billion worth of Chinese imports. And so the U.S. agreed to have those tariffs. So it's 7.5% now. But there are still tariffs in place on $360 billion of Chinese imports. And basically kind of just having this agreement in place, and, the Chinese economy has not been doing well since the president started the trade war, and they've been suffering. So I think the deal was touted as a win-win by the Chinese official yesterday, and I think that's kind of how they view it.
Daniel, in a sentence or two, we've been talking about the phase one deal. Did the president give any idea about when a second phase agreement might come about and maybe what goods, services that could affect?
Yeah, he said the phase two deal negotiations will start as soon as the phase one deal rolls out. So still kind of vague on timing on that. We don't expect anything to come before the 2020 presidential election.
All right.
But that deal will have to deal with, again, really bigger questions about the Chinese economy, steel overcapacity, cybersecurity.
Right. Harder
topics. Yeah.
We'll have to leave it there, Daniel. Daniel Moore is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Pittsburgh's technological innovations are pretty regularly highlighted by locals as a strength in the region. But what's the national impression? A proposed EPA rule could limit what kinds of scientific studies are used to create environmental and public health regulations. And Andy Warhol was a man of paradoxes. An exhibit on display at his Northside Museum takes a look at his religious life. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Every January, music fans gather around the virtual water cooler to complain about the latest inductions into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and this year is no different. The class of 2020 shines the spotlight on Whitney Houston, Notorious B.I.G., the Doobie Brothers, T-Rex, Nine Inch Nails, and Depeche Mode, while posing the question of what exactly is rock and roll. Notably absent on the roster this year, though, is the Dave Matthews Band. The beloved jam band were nominated for the first time this year, but also won the coveted fan vote, marking the first time since its debut that the fan favorites were not included in the class. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Recent tensions between the U.S. and Iran have the cybersecurity community concerned about a potential cyber response from the Iranian government. WPSU's Min Sheehan talked with Penn State professor Peter Forster, who teaches security and risk analysis and international relations.
Dr. Forster, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again and speaking with you.
The Department of Homeland Security issued an alert last week titled Potential for Iranian Cyber Response to U.S. Military Strike in Baghdad. Can you talk about how recent tensions between the U.S. and Iran may lead to increased risks of cyber attacks?
Sure. The United States and Iran have basically had frictions between them for more than 40 years. And over the last 3 to 5 years, we've seen kind of an increase in those tensions. So what happened a couple weeks ago was the death of Qasem Soleimani. He was killed by a U.S. strike. This was not a good person. But on the other hand, he was a general in the Iranian military. So this has increased tensions a bit more. And what we saw in response to that was a strike at a military base in Iraq by the Iranians. Now, we understand that the strike on the base was basically for domestic Iranian consumption. The Iranian government had to do something. They had to show their people that they were not going to allow this attack on Soleimani to go without some kind of retribution. However, I think we would be remiss to think that the Iranians are done. And this is where the cyber side of things come in. The Iranians, for quite some time, have used cyber attacks and have used cyber reconnaissance against the West and against the United States particularly. They've targeted our financial institutions. They've targeted defense contractors. We need to be prepared for what the Iranians might do next. And I think cyber attacks are a potential path forward. One, they have developed cyber capability, the Iranians. Second, the attribution of a cyber attack can be very difficult to ascertain. So those two things put together, I think, have created an environment that we need to be cautious and aware of potential cyber attacks.
And the alert also said that Iran has a history of using cyber offensive activities to retaliate against perceived harm. So let's talk about what kind of capabilities Iran have when it comes to cyber attacks.
Right. Well, Iran has a fairly developed cyber capability. In 2012, there was an attack known as Shamoon on Saudi Aramco, the Saudi oil company. And what it did in this case was Shamoon wiped the hard drives of about 30,000 computers. Didn't do any damage to any of its production capabilities, but it did eliminate a lot of data. In 2016, there was a second attack on Aramco. This weapon actually struck the safety features in Aramco, i.e. the systems that would take over if, for example, there was a rupture in a pipeline and a fire started. So what it begins to show is that the Iranians are practicing and they are developing capability. And the key is that when we see these kinds of attacks, we're not going to see them coming necessarily from Iran directly, that they will use proxy servers in multitudes of countries. So they might even use servers, hack into servers here in the U.S.
So it could get increasingly complex in that way also.
Exactly.
And Iran fired a dozen ballistic missiles in retaliation for the killing of its general, Qasem Soleimani. Yeah. And afterward, President Trump said Iran was, quote, standing down. Should we worry that the conflicts may actually be changing venue to cyberspace?
Yes, I think cyberspace is one of the areas where the Iranians would take advantage of this. Standing down, maybe a little strong of a term. I think what the Iranians will do, and we've seen this in the past, will be shift the attack vectors to a variety of different operations. But I think cyber is really an area that we need to be aware of because of their capabilities, perhaps because of some of our vulnerabilities, and because of this attribution issue that makes it so difficult to really pin them down. I think what has been shown is that the United States is willing to respond. However, the question becomes, do we really know that it was the Iranians who did this, or is it somebody in somebody's basement somewhere who wants to look like Iran attacking the United States?
What are some targets that might be especially vulnerable in these potential cyber attacks, or what might these cyber attacks look like?
I think one of the things we need to really be aware of, and there have been some recent reports that have come out about cyber attacks at utilities, so the power grid, power companies. We've seen some that have been close to other parts of critical infrastructure. Perhaps they're involved in supporting a dam. So I think the utilities would be a logical target. Now, what will these attacks look like? That's difficult for us to say. We do know that still the most popular form of attack in a cyber environment is what we call the phishing campaigns or the spear phishing campaigns. There may be other vulnerabilities, but I think really probably the most prominent one would be the spear phishing because it works.
So the potential targets can be on the national level. They could also be enterprises and individuals. So what can be done to prepare for potential cyber attacks like that?
Part of this falls to the responsibility of the organization. They should practice good cyber hygiene. You should make sure that your employees are aware of what that means. Don't be clicking on emails from people you don't know. Be careful. And perhaps in some cases, you actually make cybersecurity, or you really should in all cases, make cybersecurity part of the contracting process. There are resources there at the federal and state level, matter of fact. There's a cybersecurity office in Pennsylvania. And these are resources that enterprises should take advantage of to, one, if there's a problem, help mitigate the damage, but two, get involved with these folks earlier to understand what are good preventative strategies to better protect your systems.
Peter Forster, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about this important issue.
That was WPSU's Min Sheehan speaking with Peter Forster, who teaches security and risk analysis and international relations at Penn State. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Environmental Protection Agency is poised to finalize a rule called Strengthening Transparency in Regulatory Science. That might sound good, but it has scientists and medical professionals worried. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Julie Grant. The proposed rule would require public health researchers to release their raw data in order for EPA to consider their work when setting regulations. The rationale? These studies are not transparent enough because researchers don't release confidential information like names or home addresses. When the rule was first proposed, the agency received nearly 600,000 comments, most in opposition, including one from Dr. Mary Rice. She's a pulmonary and critical care physician and assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Broadly speaking, if the rule that we're talking about went into effect, how would your work and research be affected?
Well, it probably would not be affected much at all, at least not initially, because this rule does not really interfere with how the research is conducted. What it interferes with is how the EPA uses published studies to make decisions about health standards after the research has been completed. So to give you an example of my own research, I have a study of patients with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. The study participants carry air quality monitors around with them every day. And those air quality monitors have GPS trackers that identify where they're located at any given time. And in order to add that piece to my study, I had to take extreme measures to make sure that nobody who ever got that code could figure out who the study participants were. So I worked with the vendor to scramble the GPS data And then after I collect all those coordinates, I unscramble that data behind a firewall so that if anyone were ever to get it, they couldn't make sense of the GPS coordinates. They couldn't figure out where the study participants were located. And so to comply with this rule, I would have to make all the data of my study participants available in some kind of public database. And that would include their medical histories, the fact that they have COPD. And in the consent form that they signed, I guaranteed that I would protect their private data. So really the end result would be that that particular study would be one that the EPA would not consider. And that would really be the case for most research that involves real people living in the real world, going about their daily lives.
How does it impact things if a study like that is not usable by EPA?
Well, that's the piece that I'm most concerned about. The research we're talking about is the research that involves real children and adults and how pollution affects their health. What this rule is, it's a process barrier that would block that kind of research from informing EPA policies. And these are the kinds of studies that have shown things like air pollution as a cause of premature death in older adults. It's the kind of research that's shown that air pollution is linked to worse lung function in kids and slower lung function growth as they get older.
Yeah, I mean, and we're trying to get a sense of how big of a deal this proposed rule is, or if it stands out as different from what's happened in other administrations.
I think this rule is particularly scary because we're not talking about one pollutant or one policy or one health standard. This is a rule that would cut across the entire rulemaking process for all types of EPA policy. And I'm very concerned that the implications of such a change for our health and the next generation could be extensive and even irreversible.
Dr. Mary Rice is Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Julie Grant.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Each weekday on WESA and stations around the country, host Molly Wood and her colleagues from Marketplace Tech try to make the intersection of technology and the economy more accessible for us all. On January 30th, she will lead a local panel of experts to discuss Pittsburgh's role in the future of tech innovation. The Confluence's Megan Harris connected with Wood from her home in San Francisco.
For your own program, Marketplace Tech, you wrapped up 2019 with a declaration of sorts that if the 2000s were about the rise of the internet and the 2010s were about software, you know, kind of how we learn to use that technology, what do you imagine is coming for 2020?
I mean, I think 2020 is about artificial intelligence. I really do. This is the point where we are going to start to take all of the data that we have been collecting over the past two decades, almost even without realizing it, and trying to use it to make predictions, trying to use it to create efficiencies. And I think we're going to have to try to figure out if it's going to work, if artificial intelligence is going to be based on data that's just as flawed and biased as the humans who created it in the first place, you know, whether it the promise can actually deliver. But I think this is the year, the decade where we're going to figure that out. And some new technologies like 5G are going to make it a part of our everyday lives in ways that we might not even see.
It feels like we've been hearing about 5G forever. Are we ever going to see a real full-scale 5G rollout?
I mean, man, I hope so. I know that Pittsburgh is a limited rollout city.
Correct.
I think there are a lot, you know, San Francisco is a limited rollout city.
Yeah, there's your phone will connect for a second. You'll see it in the corner, but you don't actually know what it's doing. And it's obviously not connecting us on this grand scale that we keep hearing about.
Right. And I think it's going to be a while before that happens. I really do. Because, you know, as we know from the physical world, in many ways, infrastructure is a really hard problem to solve, especially in the United States. I talked to actually the president of Qualcomm, who said, listen, operators are having to try to negotiate neighborhood by neighborhood to install 5G cells. And so it is going to take a while. Now, the computing power is there to develop the artificial intelligence. The cars can figure out how to drive themselves. But in terms of realizing the full promise of cars that are all talking to each other, roads that are talking to cars, robots that are talking to manufacturing hubs, we still have a ways to go.
We're talking to Marketplace Tech host Molly Wood ahead of her trip to Pittsburgh. Molly, I'd love to hear about some of the tech trends that you're experiencing and how they might relate to the future of Pittsburgh. Let's go through a few quickly here. Robotics and AI make up a huge component of our university offerings here in Pittsburgh. What are your projections for those students' job prospects? I mean, is there a ceiling yet on the job growth in this sector?
Not that I can see at all. In fact, I think, you know, as computing gets more powerful itself, as we start to see the development of quantum computing, and we have to, you know, people have to figure out how to write algorithms that can either mimic quantum computing or actually work on these completely new types of computers, that you're going to see the demand for understanding of artificial intelligence only increase.
What about the funding models? The venture capitalists out there have seemed kind of limitless almost for years now in terms of what they're able to invest. Could there be any kind of contraction in the dollars that are floating out for startups?
I do think that there will be. And I think actually, you know, to Pittsburgh's benefit and other cities' benefit, that venture capital is looking for other places to put its money. I think you're really starting to see, and again, it's a slow-moving trend. It's a small percentage of venture capital right now in the 5% range, but you are starting to see a geographic diversity, and venture capitalists really insist on that because you just need ideas to come from everywhere. That said, I think we are going to see a bit of a pullback, and it might just be in amounts. You might actually see less money overall, but more diversity of businesses, and I think that could be a good thing for the startup economy.
So geographic diversity, do we anticipate those VCs paying more attention to startups led by women or people of color? Your show Marketplace Tech reported on this twice in the last year, that investors are leaving a ton of money on the table by not investing in diverse leaders.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's research that shows that the amount of money overall in terms of, you know, global investment in tech companies could be trillions of dollars left on the table.
Speaking of money, I want to turn to politics briefly. It seems like much of 2019 was dominated by a trade war with China. President Trump signed a phase one deal with Chinese officials just yesterday. If it all goes to plan, do you think that that could cool some of the concerns that American manufacturers, farmers, even other global economies have felt since the U.S. sort of reevaluated its regulations in the last year?
I think that even a phase one deal probably won't quell all of the uncertainty. And certainly in the tech industry, you know, this tariff war,
was it a Pandora's box of its kind?
I think it was. And I think it really exposed for, you know, companies and even consumers how global our supply chains really are. And I think in the tech industry in particular, you know, China is one of the only places that competition is actually coming from.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris talking to Molly Wood. She's headed to Pittsburgh at the end of this month to talk to a panel of local experts about tech trends in the area. Molly, Pennsylvania is a swing state. Election year is finally upon us. Feels like it's been here for a very long time. How do you anticipate threats to cybersecurity affecting the conversation around our 2020 elections?
This is something that cybersecurity professionals are just tearing their hair out about. They really are. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at the security of elections overall with voting machines, databases of voter information, those are all areas that were proven to be vulnerable in 2016 and that have not been significantly shored up since. I think there was only one Democratic campaign that actually had a chief security officer, Pete Buttigieg, and I think that that chief security officer has since resigned. And so I think when it comes to election security, it is an issue that really, it's probably a little late to start addressing it now, but needs to be addressed in a serious way and is not a problem that's going away.
What about political advertising? Any chance we'll see less quote-unquote fake news on our social media platforms in the short term?
I'm going to say there is virtually no chance that we will see less fake news on our social media platforms. And that's, you know, that's such a huge conversation right now. You've seen basically the three big purveyors of information. You've seen Google, Twitter, and Facebook all take completely different stances when it comes to dealing with political advertising. Twitter said, we're not going to allow any until we can figure out how to moderate it. Google said, you can pay for political advertising on our platform, but you cannot precisely target that advertising. And Facebook said, we're going to make it easier for you, the consumer, to decide not to see this advertising, but we're not going to put any other restrictions on either the targeting or the content. of the advertising. And so far, I don't know what those tools are supposed to look like on Facebook in terms of seeing less. So I think it's going to vary by platform, but I think it's an opportunity for everybody to start to have a conversation about the messaging that they're seeing. Because in the short term, it comes down to us not believing everything we see, or us having the ability to say, boy, this message seems to, you know, this tweet or this Facebook post really seems to want to make me angry and upset or afraid. I wonder why that is.
Do you think, talking about the workforce of tomorrow, do you think that the U.S. has the time and the talent to train enough people to be a part of what we're calling kind of the future of work?
So I've had some interesting conversations actually with companies who are trying to reframe the way we think about our workers. And the reframing is all about skills. So not necessarily saying, you know, you have to have this degree, you have to have had this amount of school, you have to have had these three jobs or this many years of experience prior to coming to work here. It's more about saying, okay, how can we figure out how to evaluate the skills that someone has? Maybe a teacher actually has incredible project management skills and can be trained to, you know, help run a bunch of robots. Like, there's ways to do skills matching that I think are really promising and interesting. And that's just sort of a fascinating development when it comes to figuring out how to redeploy an existing workforce by recognizing that they have the skills to do the job and that they may not need as much training as we think.
How do you see that playing out for a city like Pittsburgh?
I mean, I think one of the smart things that Pittsburgh has done is turn that history of manufacturing, for example, into AI and robotic manufacturing. And so I think there is some skills transfer that can happen there. It is not an easy problem to solve, and it is going to rely on local business, existing university structures, and probably local government.
How important from where you sit is, you know, quality of life in these cities where, you know, the talent might be considering moving, but maybe not sold on a particular place, especially maybe a mid-sized city, not Seattle, not LA, not New York. How do you see a city like Pittsburgh trying to get talent to come and to stay, to put down roots?
I mean, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it seems that everybody wants to leave because it is so expensive. The, you know, social problems are so large. I think that actually mid-sized cities in America are really having a moment. In fact, some of the fastest growing parts of the country are mid-sized cities because there's a nationwide housing crisis. Traffic is real and awful and terrible. And, you know, I think it's a really good sell, actually, to say we have a good quality of life and you can buy a house here. And that cannot be underestimated. I mean, certainly Pittsburgh is a world-class tech city, right? Carnegie Mellon, the autonomous driving development that's been there, that it's often referred to, I think, as the birthplace of artificial intelligence or the place where artificial intelligence was invented. I mean, people will go where there is not only a good quality of life, but interesting, compelling work that can have a huge difference. And sometimes it is better to be in a place where you can really stand out, where you really feel that you can make that difference. Is it enough? I don't know. I guess, like, time will tell.
Oh, gosh, you're going to make a lot of Pittsburgh leaders very happy with that statement.
Time will tell. I don't know for sure. But look, everybody I know is having the same conversation, which is, why do we live here? So now is the time, Pittsburgh leaders, to capitalize on that sentiment.
From the outside, what is the national perspective on Pittsburgh, especially their place in the digital economy?
I think Pittsburgh is pretty regularly named as the kind of small cluster of mid-sized cities that have figured out an angle. You know, you've seen Boston say, our deal is biotech. And Pittsburgh has said, our deal is AI, robotics, and manufacturing. And it's very smart because it plays on kind of a reputation that the city already has, and it makes a lot of sense. It is simply a logical way to develop, and it has a lot of value.
Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech. You can catch her in person in Pittsburgh at the end of this month in conversation with WESA and others. Molly, thanks so much, and safe travels to town.
Thank you, Megan. See you soon.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Andy Warhol was known for iconic works of pop art, experimental films, and a community based in his New York City studio called the factory. But there's another side to this silver-haired art giant that's explored in an exhibit at the museum that is named for him on the north side. Joining us in studio for a glimpse of how his Catholic faith influenced his work is WESA art and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Kevin.
When he was still Andrew Warhola, he was raised Byzantine Catholic. Bill, how did that community affect his early years?
Well, Warhol was born in Pittsburgh in 1928. His parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, and they were very devoutly Catholic. In fact, they moved. Folks know that he lived in the South Oakland neighborhood. His parents actually moved there because to be closer to their church, which was St. John Chrysostom, which a church that still exists down in Greenfield, down in the run there. You can see it from the parkway. It's got the Byzantine crosses on it, right, and the yellow facade brick, and it's lit up at night. So it's quite a landmark in Pittsburgh still.
Later, when he moved to New York and began to make his mark on the world, how did that those Catholic roots come into play?
Well, it comes through in a lot of his work in ways that you might not think about. And one of the things this exhibit points out, it's called Warhol Revelation, is his very well-known practice of doing multiple images, you know, the multiple Marilyns, multiple Elvises, things like that. The curators of this show trace it actually back to his, the Catholic saints cards and that would be replicated, and in which in traditional art, things being unique and original and one of a kind gives them value. In this Catholic tradition of these cards, multiples gives them power. And that's kind of the thing that Warhol drew on in making this art.
Warhol was known for his bohemian parties in the factory and his artistic plays on fame and glamour. But he was then later lauded for his quiet piety. How did he reconcile those different identities?
That's a great question, because no one really seems sure how he did or even that he did, actually. It seems like these two parts of him might have existed side by side. His nephew, Donald Warhola, who still lives in Pittsburgh and works for the museum, knew his Uncle Andy quite well, you know, back in the 80s before his untimely death. And he said he was kind of two different people in a way. He was the person he was in private, very family-oriented, very quiet. And then he was in public, he was this persona that he felt he had to put on in a way.
Hmm. What are some of the works included?
There's some great ones in there. One of the most notable was probably his big Last Supper, which was some of the last works that Warhol did were these versions of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper in Warhol's own fashion, silkscreen replicating based on this original image that the exhibit actually includes the original image that he used, which is itself a reproduction, which is a very Warholian technique. And so those are great to see. They're really large scale and really striking.
Mm-hmm. The exhibit includes some art from his mother?
Yes, it does. His mother drew, you know, angels and things like that, and her script was often incorporated in Warhol's own early commercial work. He loved her handwriting, so you can see samples of that in the show.
He actually had a commission from the Catholic Church. What was that for?
It was for the World's Fair in 1967 in San Antonio. It was a film he did called Sunset. It was never actually, the pavilion never went up, so this is a rare chance to see that rather beautiful, quiet, meditative film.
Bill, you've been reporting on art and culture for many years. What have you learned about Warhol from this exhibit that you didn't know before?
Well, one thing was you talked about his quiet piety that was lauded in his eulogy when he died back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Warhol was, even into the 80s, was a regular churchgoer. He didn't often stay for the whole Mass or take communion or go to confession or anything, but he often popped into the Catholic churches of New York. And we can only speculate what he found there, but that was an interesting little fact.
Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Bill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure thing, Kevin.
The exhibit, Andy Warhol Revelation, continues at the Warhol Museum through February 16th. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program, or would like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence, or, of course, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. We had production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.